So I don't know if many of you saw or read this book from the 1970s, turned into a film in 1970 called The Forbin Project. And this was a story, kind of a predictable science fiction story from the time, of a president who found himself enormously anxious about the decision whether or not to launch nuclear weapons. And at a certain point, he decided it was a decision humans couldn't make. And so he asked the leading computer scientist, a man named Dr. Forbin, to build a computer to make the decision for him. And Forbin built this computer, and of course the computer is turned on, and instantly the computer begins to outpace anybody's understanding of what it would learn. And then it discovers that there's another computer in Russia that had been built at exactly the same time, and they want to talk to each other. And then after they talk to each other, they begin to take over the world by demanding that humans listen to the computers, and when humans don't, they start dropping nuclear bombs in various parts of the world until humans eventually learn. Now, I want you to think about this problem and think about it as a Forbin problem. It has two components. The first component is a technology, a kind of machines gone wild, machines that we lose control over. And the second part is an extraordinary anxiety, a lack of confidence that leads to these machines being allowed to take over, go wild. Here, the president in the film, who had the fear, the anxiety about whether he could intervene to control this decision. And so the temptation that he engages is to yield to the technology. And he yields because he has lost the confidence in human judgment necessary in the context. That's a Forbin problem. So if that's a Forbin problem, let's look at some examples of Forbin problems, which I think as you see this, you'll begin to see everywhere. I want to talk about two. The first is this story written by Felix Salmon in Wired magazine about this man, David Li, a Chinese immigrant to Canada, who came up with in 2000 the paper that led to the formula that produced the market securitization for mortgages that led to the catastrophe we've seen in the mortgage market. He developed something called the Gaussian coupla, a model to price these mortgages, to take this extraordinary complexity for pricing mortgages and to render it extremely simple. Now, as Salmon describes, this model spread like wildfire in the financial communities. As he describes, at the end of 2001, there was $920 billion in credit default swaps outstanding. By the end of 2007, that number had skyrocketed to more than $62 trillion. And at the heart of all of this was Li's formula. Now, of course, the problem was that Li's formula was flawed, and it introduced this systemic danger into the market. Not because any given trader adopted it, but because every trader did. In financial markets, everybody doing the same thing is the classic recipe for a bubble and an inevitable bust. So that's element one of the Forbin problem, right? Technology, machines run wild. Element two is the inability of the managers to exercise judgment, to intervene, to overcome the problem caused by the technology. So, as he writes, in hindsight, ignoring these warnings looks foolhardy, but at the time it was easy. Banks dismissed them partly as the managers empowered to apply the brakes didn't understand the arguments between the various arms of the quant universe, the quants, the geniuses who invented these technologies. So, here we had a technology built by the quants, but that can't be controlled by the managers, leading the financial system to march off this cliff. Or think about a second example. Think about patents as a kind of technology, a kind of technology, machines run wild. My colleague from Stanford, Mark Lemley, describes how in the 20th century, all of the enabling technologies of the time were basically technologies that were in the public domain. Computer hardware, software, the internet, biotechnologies. These were technologies that were unpatented, either intentionally unpatented or accidentally, because the patents were declared invalid or whole fields were not subject to patent. The 20th century was thus a century of innovation, enabling technologies on top of a platform of free enabling technologies. The patents, the important patents for innovation, happened on top of that free platform. 21st century is radically different. The enabling technologies of the 21st century, these new technologies, are all patented. Think about nanotechnology, as Lemley describes. Most of the basic ideas in nanotechnology are either already patented or may well end up be patented very soon. One core technology, carbon nanotubes, there are more than 200 patents at the core of carbon nanotube technology right now. Now, that's not necessarily bad. My claim is not that patents are necessarily bad. Sometimes patents are necessary. Sometimes they are helpful. But what we know is sometimes they're also harmful. Here's Bill Gates talking about patents in software technology. He wrote, "If people had understood how patents would be granted when most of today's ideas were invented and had taken out patents, the industry would be at a complete standstill today." Gates' solution to this problem? To patent as much as Microsoft can. As he said, "A future startup with no patents of its own will be forced to pay whatever price the giants choose to impose. That price might be high. Established companies have an interest in excluding future competitors." So the point is, if patents as a technology are sometimes needed and sometimes not, then what is needed here is the judgment to decide in what context we should be deploying these patents. But that judgment is lacking in the current political context. We instead have this race without limit to patent as broadly and as extensively as we can. So judgment here. In our culture, we have a technology for exercising this kind of judgment. A machine looks a little bit like this. And the question we should ask is, do we at all have confidence in this machine to exercise the judgment we need to avoid the Forbin problems that are spreading everywhere in our society? Because we all recognize a certain corrosion in the effectiveness of this machine. As described in this extraordinary book by Robert Kaiser, So Damn Much Money, there is an extraordinary economy of influence at the core of that machine, an economy fed by lobbyists feeding members who feed interests who then feed the lobbyists. Each, as Kaiser describes, pays the other. So the most obvious interest-paying lobbyists. Since Bill Clinton was president, we've doubled the number of lobbyists in Washington. We've doubled the price per hour of lobbyists in Washington as well. Those lobbyists feed members, both during the time that they are members and after they are members. So during the time they are members, they get paid with cash. Not cash in brown paper bags, I'm not talking about bribery, but cash to support campaigns. As the cost of campaigns goes skyrocketing through the roof, these members become increasingly dependent upon this help from lobbyists to fund their campaigns. And this change is, as Kaiser describes, something importantly new. As he writes, "Money has been part of American politics forever, on occasion in the Gilded Age or in the Harding administration, for example, much more blatantly than recently. But the scale of it has just gotten way out of hand. The money may have come in brown paper bags in earlier eras, but the politicians needed and took much less of it than they take through more formal channels today." That's during their time as members, and then after they are members, they get fed by lobbyists. As my friend Jim Cooper, congressman from Tennessee, describes, Capitol Hill has increasingly become a farm league for K Street. Members and staffers and bureaucrats have this increasingly common business model in their head, focused on life after government, life as lobbyists. 50%, as Public Citizen calculated between 1998 and 2004, of senators leave the Senate to go be lobbyists. 42% of members of the House. In this way, too, then, the lobbyists pay members. And then finally, the members pay the interests. So in the first 6 months of the Bush administration, Enron paid $2.5 million to lobby that administration to avoid the regulations that might have led us to understand just what kind of Ponzi scheme that energy company was. Fannie and Freddie spent $900,000 in the first 6 months of 2008 to avoid regulations that might have led us to understand something about the problems that they were facing too. $1.3 million spent in 2006 by the top hedge funds to avoid the regulations that might have led us to understand something of the trouble that, in fact, we saw blow up just last year. These are all examples of policies that get bent to those who pay for the policymaking. In one study calculated by University of Kansas, the return on investment from lobbyist dollars spent in this particular statute was 22,000%. For every dollar spent, 22,000% return. Now the point is, this is an economy, as Kaiser describes it. It's an economy that has consequences. The consequences are fundamentally bent policy, from esoteric areas like copyright to fundamental areas like global climate change. Every single issue that you worry about is fundamentally affected by this economy, an economy that I think we should recognize as a certain kind of corruption. Not a corruption in the traditional sense of people trying to feather their personal nest. That's not the problem I'm talking about. Corruption, a kind of good souls corruption. People engaging in legal, even ethical acts, which have the consequence to weaken the capacity of an entity to do its job. In this case, to exercise sensible judgment, sense, judgment driven towards sense, not driven towards ways to raise campaign dollars. So, when I see an event like this, and there have been hundreds of events like this across our country, leaders from the nation gathered together to focus on this question, a question that's been asked thousands of times over the last 10 years, I would wish that we would focus less on the technology in that question and more on our capacity for judgment that's necessary because of the way this technology is spread. It's that capacity that we've lost. It's that capacity we need a way to re-find if we're to deal with the potential and the potential harm that these technologies present. Thank you very much.